was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. So I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand. Then I said, listen, bud, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man.
Good morning, radio fans from around the Shuswap and around the world. The question for today is, for what was the elder Jim Watt noted? What was important that Jim Watt, the elder, discovered or created or invented? In the good old days, and yes, I do believe there were good old days, and I lived through some of them, things weren't nearly as complicated then as they are today, and one could carry out one's daily work or play without a wireless device attached somewhere to his or her anatomy. When every procedure, event, activity, and method had usually one or two names associated with it, and not a series of names reduced to an acronym or a logo or just plain initials like CRA, CBSA, MTO, FM, CSAA, NAFMP, and where one needed to carry a glossary with him or herself in order to figure out what the initials stood for. Also, each of these events did not require a computer program attached to it, because there were no computers, of course. And when someone needed something, all he had to do, he or she, was to pick up the telephone, which was normally attached to the wall or sitting on the hall table, and either ask the operator, because there was no dial, to connect or manual turn that little rotary thingy on the telephone to the desired numbers to reach the party of choice. Every call was answered by a real live voice, by a real live person who was usually authorized and knowledgeable enough to deal with the situation. There were no automatic computerized messages like, thank you for holding, we are experiencing an above average volume of calls. Your call is important to us, all our representatives are busy assisting other callers. Please stay on the line and your call will be answered in the order it was received. 30 or 40 minutes later, one is still listening to the same terrible music and the same annoying recording repeated every 30 seconds, while, of course, losing game after game of solitaire on the computer, only adding to the frustration. I can see you nodding your head. Once a representative finally does take your call, he or she can barely be understood and has absolutely no idea as to where in the world you might be calling from, or why you might be calling, or how she or he may resolve your issue. But where would we be without Alexander Graham Bell's invention, which changed forever the way business was conducted, even today with its minor annoyances? The good old days. Pull up your chairs, kiddies, and listen.
One ringy dingy. Two ringy dingies. A gracious good afternoon. This is Miss Tomlin at the telephone company. Have I reached the party to whom I am speaking? Mr. Veedle? Mr. Veedle, you owe us a balance of $23.64. When may we expect payment? Pardon? When what freezes over? No. Mr. Veedle, you are not dealing with just anyone's fool. I am a high school graduate. Now then, when may we expect payment? Oh, Mr. Veedle, I don't see why you're kicking up such a ruckus when, according to our files, your present bank balance plus stocks, securities, and other holdings amount to exactly privileged information. Oh, Mr. Veedle! Oh, that's so cute. No. You're dealing with the telephone company. For instance, as I look through your income tax return for 19... Oh, Mr. Veedle, you don't understand. We are not subject to city, state, or federal regulations. We are omnipotent. That's potent with an omni in front of it. Now then, when may we expect payment? Oh, dear me, Mr. Veedle. I'm afraid we're going to have to discontinue your outgoing service. And if we do not receive payment within 10 days, we will send a large, burly serviceman to your home to rip it out of the wall. I'd advise you to lock up the liquor. He's a mean drunk. Now then, wouldn't you rather pay, Mr. Veedle, than lose your service and possibly the use of one eye? Oh, dear me. You know, Mr. Veedle, I think we can persuade you to pay after all. I want you to listen to a little recorded conversation. Can you hear that all right? That's right, it is you. Do you recognize that other voice? That's right. And do you remember the basic content of that conversation? Wait a minute. I want to hear this part again. Oh, Mr. Veedle. Now, Mr. Veedle, if you're interested, we have 96 hours more. Oh, I think blackmail is such an ugly word. Let's just call it a vicious threat. Well, how very nice. It's been a pleasure talking with you. We will await your check. And Mr. Veedle, there's no reason on earth for you to feel personally persecuted. We may be the only phone company in town, but we screw everybody.
You are listening to Driving Through My Memories. This is your genial host, Ed Murdoch, along with his co-driver, Dan White. And I hope you enjoyed that just as much as Dan and I did, sitting here rolling in our chairs. My goodness. Lily Tomlin performed that sketch on TV comedy show Laugh-In, and it was released on her album This Is a Recording in 1971. Ms. Tomlin, over her lengthy career as an actress, comedian, and producer, won 2 Tony Awards, a Grammy, 4 Emmys, and a Daytime Emmy. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there'll be a tie-in with the communications thing later as we get through the content here. However, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the railroad ruled. They were largely responsible for the development of commerce and the colonization of both Canada and the United States, especially the West. Prior to that, where there was water and a reason for it, marine commerce, largely the fur trade, thrived. Later, many canals were built to accommodate crafts larger than a freighter canoe, such as the Rideau Canal, the Trent Severn Waterway in Ontario, Newellen Canal, and the Erie, Champlain, Michigan, and other smaller ones in the United States. They carried primary products from early agriculture and logging activity in Upper Canada, the Eastern Townships, and the 13 colonies in the U.S., to the Great Lakes ports and saltwater harbors on the East Coast. Of course, marine travel was severely limited, and it was expensive to operate and maintain. Today, the St. Lawrence Seaway has greatly enhanced the ability of the Great Lake ports of call to accommodate the large Great Lakes freighters, plus many saltwater ships. Railroads created a network reaching the four corners of the continent and everywhere in between. Horse-drawn stagecoaches and freighter trains enjoyed a relatively short period in the development of the New World, while the mule and even camels were employed locally to move freight between source and market. Bactrian camels could carry twice as much a load as a mule and were fairly easy to feed and maintain. They were used on the old Douglas and Caribou roads, the first highways in British Columbia. But horses were terrified of them and bolted upon one coming into sight. Also, the camels had very soft hooves, and they had to be fitted with booties because of the harsh terrain. And their diet often included articles of clothing such as shirts and pants, and bars of soap, necessities of the day. So they were not a great success. The big railway companies acquired huge tracts of land, which they leased and or sold to immigrants wishing to till the soil, thereby creating a ready-made commodity for them to ship to domestic and ultimately foreign markets. Coal was discovered in Alberta and eastern British Columbia around then, when most steam locomotives had converted to coal from wood as a fuel, and the resource became a valuable power source for the new mechanical age of steam and soon electrical power. Even today, 13% of Canada's energy requirements are produced by coal, much of it carried by train. Many railway barons became very wealthy. Some never even set foot on North American soil, such as Lord Revelstoke, a British baron and a banker who helped rescue the infant Canadian Pacific Railroad, and after whom the town of Revelstoke in beautiful British Columbia was named. During the previous program, we started but ran out of time to finish the Canadian Railroad trilogy written and performed by Gordon Lightfoot. The song was honored in 2001 as one of the Canadian Masterworks by the Audiovisual Preservation Trust of Canada. You will remember also that Pierre Burton, who wrote the definitive history of the CPR in The National Dream and The Last Spike, said, "You know, Gord, you said as much in that song as I said in my book." Did I mention that I sang with Gordon Lightfoot on CBC television years ago?
There was a time in this fair land when the railroad did not run. When the wild, majestic mountains stood alone against the sun. Long before the white man and long before the wheel. When the green, dark forest was too silent to be real. But time has no beginnings and history has no bounds. As to this verdant country, they came from all around. They sailed upon her waterways and they walked the forest tall. Built the mines, the mills, and the factories for the good of us all. And when the young man's fancy had turned into the spring, for to hear the hammers ring. Their minds were overflowing with the visions of their day, with many a fortune won and lost and many a debt to pay. For they looked in the future and wanted to see this on iron road running from the sea to the sea. Get on our way, 'cause we're moving too slow. Bring in the workers and bring up the rails. We gotta lay down the tracks and tear up the trails. Open your heart, let the lifeblood flow. Gotta get on. Across the white prairie, our loved ones lie sleeping. Beyond the dark oceans, in a place far away, we are the navvies who were bright blazing song. Living on stew and drinking bad whiskey, mending our backs till the long days are done. We are the navvies who work upon the railway, swinging our hammers in the bright blazing sun, laying down track and building the bridges, bending our backs till the railroad is done. St. Lawrence all the way to Gaspé, swinging our hammers and drawing up bay, driving them in and tying them down, away to the bunkhouse and into the town. A dollar a day and a place for my head, a drink to the living, a toast to the dead. Oh, the song stood alone against the sun, long before the white man and long before the wheel, when the green dark forest was too silent to be real, when the green dark forest was too silent to be real, and many other dead men. Silent to be real,
well, you almost don't need to read the book after that. However, if you haven't, I would highly recommend it. Pierre Burton's National Dream and the Last Spike. Actually, the National Dream, it's pretty political. It's about Sir John A. Macdonald's conservative government trying to raise the money and going to England to the bankers to back the project. Whereas The Last Spike is more action-packed and about the actual building of the railroad. Very, very excellent book. I highly recommend it. And the CBC turned that book into a documentary on television. If you can get a hold of that sometime, it's certainly worth a watch as well. That was, of course, Gordon Lightfoot with the Canadian Railroad Trilogy. Over the years, as the quality and quantity of roads and highways in Canada improved, the rail has given way to the over-the-road transport industry. The railroad's even becoming part of that major industry as truck carriers. Today, 90% of all consumer goods are shipped by road transport. In the early days, there were a few companies who were private carriers and could only transport their own products from point A to B and then go to the nearest source of a raw product for a backhaul, which could be used in the manufacture of their specialty. Truckers were accustomed then to many empty, non-paying miles. Once the U.S. deregulated, new markets became available for cross-border commerce, and Canada quickly followed suit with its own deregulation. While there still remain a few private carriers, the majority of goods are moved by for hire companies from destination to destination with few empty miles in between, thereby maximizing the efficiency of both drivers and equipment. Were you aware that trucks and drivelines are designed to run under load and trailers are designed to carry their gross weight capacity, and that running empty is actually harder on the equipment than running with a load on board? It is also less safe as the handling characteristics change dramatically. Most modern carrier dispatch offices today are contractually linked to one or more websites which post pickup and delivery truckload information, including commodity and weight, and any information pertaining to special requirements for transit, such as specialized equipment, hazmat permits, and such. The only information withheld is the actual name of the shipper and receiver until the contract has been consummated, which takes place usually, and here's the connection to the first part of the program, by telephone and fax machine. Terms of payment are agreed upon at this time and are usually 30 or 60 days and rarely 90. This transaction must take place with the least amount of delay so as not to keep the truck and driver waiting and enable the driver to maintain a legal and appropriate log. You can see that if there was a major malfunction of technical communication infrastructure, the economy of the nations affected would be catastrophically impacted. This is a definite possibility that puts fear and trembling into the hearts of the big players in the game, and is a real threat that must be considered seriously and treated with the utmost diligence. National and internal security is a huge concern, and there are regulations in place that must be followed with great care in handling every link in this entire supply chain and all its components, in order to avoid liability and punitive lawsuits that can cause financial collapse and ruin in an instant of indiscretion or careless execution. One wonders if the governments take this as seriously as the corporate players. Bruce Coburn, who will be spotlighted at the 2013 Roots and Blues Festival here in Salmon Arm, BC, in August, wonders what's going on too. And here's what he has to say about it.
The only thing that matters. trucks of midnight moving on. Moving on.
Some pretty harsh moments and comments there from Mr. Coburn 22 years ago. His musical focus as a folk rock guitarist, singer, songwriter has gone from an urban to a global and then a more political outlook as he vigorously took on more and more progressive causes. Maybe he'll sing that tune at this year's Roots and Blues Festival in Salmonarm, British Columbia. Coburn's political activism has embraced international human rights travesties, and he has played many benefit concerts and written songs of international importance, and his activity in this arena continues to this day. Nonetheless, Bruce was named a member of the Order of Canada in 1982, promoted to an officer in 2002, and in 2012, just last year, Bruce Coburn received the Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Medal. And among many other tributes, he's received seven, count them, honorary doctorate degrees from Queen's University in Kingston, Memorial University in Newfoundland, University of Victoria here in BC, York University in Toronto, McMaster, where I went, in Hamilton, St. Thomas University in New Brunswick, and the prestigious Berklee College of Music in Boston, where Bruce spent three semesters in the mid-60s. Appropriately, as you will see, we are changing gears here, and we're going into overdrive for the cruise to our destination. Listen up. Jim Watt worked for the little city of Enderby in the North Okanagan of British Columbia for 30 years, and to honor his presence, the city built and named a beautiful kilometer-long heritage walkway on the lovely banks of the Shuswap River. It comes with strategically placed picnic tables, interpretive plaques describing the history and life of the river, and passes the grand log structure housing the Chamber of Commerce and the Center for Tourist Information. A different James Watt from Scotland was a mechanical engineer who passed away almost 200 years ago. That Mr. Watt spent quite a bit of his waking hours fiddling around with steam engines, and is considered the creator of the modern version of that power source. But wait a minute. The answer to the question of the day is, he needed a way to measure the output of these instruments of power. And because horses were commonly used to transport people and carry items to market, as we have already mentioned, he used the horse as the basis for his calculations. Can you see where we're going with this? Now, our Scottish Jim Watt cleverly assumed that a horse can lift 550 pounds 1 foot in 1 second, establishing forever that one horsepower is equal to 550 foot-pounds per second. Okay, now that equates to the amount of work over time. So power, or P, equals W, or work, divided by T, or time. P equals W over T. Without going into the science of it all, because I am not an engineer, let it be suffice to say that brake horsepower, or BHP, is the rating at the crankshaft, and power to the wheels or to the ground is the horsepower applied to the actual movement of a vehicle after the loss of running the accessories and running gear. So, now if you have a truck with 550 horsepower engine, it might put out only 4.25 horsepower to the ground, having used 125 horses running the alternator, the air compressor, the air conditioning and heater, environmental accessories, transmission, and differentials. The most powerful engine I ran was a 5.25 horsepower Cummins in a Freightliner back in the late 70s, so it didn't have all the accessories to deplete its power before reaching the ground. On one occasion, grossing 128,000 pounds, hauling a trainload of stainless steel coils from Dofasco in Hamilton to Continental Can in Montreal, a distance of 385 miles, we took 6 hours and 22 minutes at an average speed of 62 miles an hour, never once stopping the truck for any reason, nor did we change a gear, even once during this trip. I use the royal we here, though I was alone in the unit, just so you don't think I'm bragging. Where horsepower is measured in pounds per foot, torque is measured in feet per pound. If you hold a 1 pound weight straight out from your shoulder, your arm is about 2 feet from your shoulder, the torque on your shoulder would be 2 foot-pounds. 1 pound weight in your hand plus 2 feet of distance, 2 foot-pounds. If you held a 10-pound weight in your hand, the torque would be 20 foot-pounds. Think of torque as the amount of force that is required to swing a door on its hinges. The closer you get to the hinges, the more force you have to apply to move the door. So, torque measures turning or rotational force. If you put a 2-foot wrench on a truck wheel and apply 1,000 pounds of force to it, you would achieve 2,000 foot-pounds of torque. You might even make the truck move. The critical thing to remember here is that the most important part of the physics equation applied to moving a fully loaded semi-truck is the engine's torque and its gearing. In a typical North American automobile that you might drive, you might have a 2 liter 260 horsepower engine with a 275 foot-pound of torque at 3,800 RPMs with a 4-speed transmission. A Class 8 semi-truck might have a 15 liter 550 horsepower engine with 2,050 foot-pounds of torque at 1,250 RPM and an 18-speed transmission. So you see, the horsepower difference is not that great, only about 2.5 times more. But the torque is 8 times higher than a car at 1/3 of the RPM with 4.5 times more gears. And it's the gearing that makes the difference. Without getting into all the mathematics, gear ratios, torque rise, bore and stroke sizes, etc., I think you get the picture. An average car engine and transmission will weigh maybe 450 to 600 pounds. An average Class 8 diesel engine and transmission will weigh from 5 to 6,000 pounds. It's amazing how the mind works, eh? Here we were talking about horses and engines, okay, railroad engines and camel's feet and pounds of cargo, and now we've been talking about horsepower and engine torque and foot-pounds, and in my humble opinion, we're ready for a horsepower break.
I was born in a hurry, but there wasn't any place to to it. I guess I always knew it. What it is that makes my world go round. It's a matter of horsepower for 8 seconds or miles an hour. That's the way I am, and it's a fact I can't ignore. Yeah, big four-legged, fuel injected, running wild, radar detected. A man can always stand a little bit more horsepower. Well, the view looks better from ahead than it looks behind. I got a need for speed, and I don't mean the drugstore kind. Some people like a life that barely moves at all. I say more power to them, then I fly right through. Till it slows down to a crawl. Then I think about horsepower for 8 seconds or miles an hour. That's the way I am, and it's a fact I can't ignore. Big four-legged, fuel injected, running wild, radar detected. A man can always stand a little bit more horsepower. Yeah.
It isn't often you hear of someone winning a college scholarship for rodeo riding, but that is exactly what brought Chris Ledoux to the point where he won the Intercollegiate National Bareback Riding Championship when he was in his junior year at Casper College in, oddly enough, Casper, Wyoming. I know it well. There's a truck weigh scale there. By 1970, Ledoux had become a professional rodeo rider. And to raise money to pay for travel expenses, he started writing songs about his lifestyle. You just heard one of them. Within 10 years on the circuit, Ledoux had sustained enough injuries to persuade him to retire from professional riding and concentrate on his music and his family. His live concerts, which included mechanical bull riding and fireworks, achieved considerable popularity, and Chris continued writing and recording his and other writers' songs until 2000, when he was diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening illness that required a liver transplant. His good friend Garth Brooks offered to donate part of his liver, which turned out not to be a match, but a compatible donor was found, and following his release from hospital, Chris released two more albums before his condition had developed into carcinoma, and sadly, he passed away in March of 2009. In an alarming announcement recently, a senior consultant with the Freight Transportation Research Associates, or FTA, said that if all the new regulations currently being considered by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, the FMCSA, came to be applied, just the American trucking industry alone could be in need of 1 million drivers in just 3 years. That's by 2016. Now that is truly startling. I got a call from an owner-operator a few nights ago asking about the new reset rule in the United States, where prior to July the 1st of this year, one could reset his or her logbook to hours to zero after a 34-hour period of being off duty and apply the ruling as frequently as necessary. That has been changed now to only being able to use the reset once in any week or 7-day stretch, and there has to be two, count them, two overnight rest periods within that 34-hour break. I can't bring myself to call them sleep periods because even the United States government can't force a person to sleep. They can force you to take the time off, but they can't force you to sleep. That means, if that rule is followed, a driver finishes his run early on the first morning, he or she would then be required to take almost 48 hours off instead of 34 in order to comply. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. It should be 2 8-hour rest periods required within the 34-hour break, period. That would be reasonable. And what's the problem with taking multiple 34-hour resets in a 7-day period? I don't get it. The more you take, I would think the more rested you are, and the more rested you are, the safer you are. Isn't that the bottom line? The goal the administration is attempting to achieve? Well, no, of course not. It is pure and simply a ruse to collect more taxes from fuel and registration and revenue from fines and penalties to help fill the depleting U.S. Treasury. And let me tell you, angry, frustrated truckers aren't exactly in a safe, defensive driving mood. And to tell you how he feels about the whole mess, here is Chris Ledoux's good friend, Garth Brooks. And he mentions Ledoux in the last verse. Listen for it.
This old highway's getting longer. It seems there ain't no end in sight. To sleep would be best, but I just can't afford to rest. I got a ride in Denver tomorrow night. I called the house, but no one answered. For the last 2 weeks, no one's been home. I guess she's through with me. To tell the truth, I just can't see what's kept the woman holding on this long. And the white line's getting longer, and the saddle's getting cold. I'm much too young to feed this damn old. Getting younger, tougher bronze, you know I can't recall. A worn out tape of Chris Ledoux, lonely women and bad dudes seem to be the only friends I've left at all. And the white line's getting longer, and the saddle's getting cold. Not much too young to feel this damn.
Well, I guess that's how I feel on some days. Garth Brooks requires very little introduction. He's enjoyed immense popularity with his live performances, while his recordings and concert attendance broke records all through the 90s. Mr. Brooks has retired at least twice, but he continues enjoying his reign as one of the most dominant and successful players in popular music history. He said this about the song that we just heard: "Much Too Young will always be my sentimental favorite because it was my very first single. It was a baby that I watched grow up. Whenever I hear it today, I have a smile on my face. I want to give a big thanks to Randy Taylor and Chris Ledoux. Randy was the writer, and Chris was probably the reason that it was played. Hey, Chris, Randy and I decided that we owe you a beer, pal." Well, I'll drink to that. The tune reached number 8 on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart. Suspicion has often been aroused. Much speculation about it up and down the road, in cafes and in drivers' rooms, kitchens, parlors, wherever drivers, their wives, both commercial and non-commercial, virtually anyone who has driven a vehicle and gotten a ticket, a citation, or a summons for speeding, following too close, failing to yield, being almost overweight, you know, any infraction imaginable. There's a suspicion that there is a quota that law enforcement officers are obligated to reach on each shift. Much of that talk, of course, is sour grapes, and most of the talkers are annoyed at themselves for getting caught in the first place, being careless, not paying attention, or seeing the police car radar trap, or whatever their excuse might be, and I see you're all nodding your head. But there is an element of truth to it all. It isn't called a quota. That would be too obvious or crass. But it is known officially in law enforcement circles as meeting performance expectations. Now there's a new catchphrase for you: meeting one's performance expectations. Recently we talked about the inspection blitz in Toronto, netting an above average of failures. We also discussed the possibility that many of the recorded infractions might have been borderline items like a loose bolt or a chip in the windshield that doesn't have any connection to a critical function of the unit and therefore does not constitute a safety issue. Is there then a suspicion that many of these recorded infractions are only a means of detailing performance expectations and not addressing the real object of the blitz, which is to improve highway safety for all users? Where does accountability enter this picture? If the ministry, in its infinite wisdom, has already decided that 20% is the target of out-of-service vehicles, and an officer is expected to at least attain that magic number, then how many of the out-of-service vehicle inspection certificates issued are really deserved, and how many of them are questionable? I have personally been queried about the location of a stop recorded on my log that was different from a fuel receipt that I had received. The fuel receipt indicated I had obtained fuel at a Shell cardlock in Sherwood Park, Alberta, which is a suburb and an integral part of the greater city of Edmonton. It was the municipality of Edmonton that I wrote on my log sheet showing my on-duty not driving stop instead of Sherwood Park. Silly me. Now, if the officer had wished to do so and was feeling the pressure to meet his performance expectations, he could have given me a 72-hour, that's 3 days, out-of-service citation, and there would have been nothing I could do about it. That would be meeting performance expectations. And then down the road, if I had written Sherwood Park instead of Edmonton, another officer, not recognizing the two as one, might ask, "Where's that?" And when I would answer Edmonton, he might say, "Well, why didn't you say so? You can't win for losing. It isn't right, is it? Life is just a highway. The road's a bit rough at times, but I want to ride it all night long, and I can't because the government has legislated that I must observe my circadian rhythms and sleep for 8 hours while I'm kept in the dark."
One day and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside the darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. With a brave heart free and lover's soul, come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate, break down the guarded gate.
There's not much time left today.
Tom Cochrane is best known for that single released in 1991, which hit number one in Canada and reached number six on the Billboard in the US of A. He was born in Ottawa in 1953, and over his career has won 7 Junos from 15 nominations. He's a member of the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, an officer of the Order of Canada, an inductee onto the Canadian Walk of Fame, and has an honorary doctorate from Brandon University. And he is an honorary colonel with the Royal Canadian Air Force. Mr. Cochrane can also unlock the door of the city of Winnipeg with the key he was given in 2012. Both he and his wife, Kathy, have been active in World Vision, Child Amnesty, the Walk of for Parkinson's, and Make Poverty History campaign. He received the Canadian Music Industry Humanitarian Award in 2005 for his benevolence.